Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast adventure to discover the entertainment that changed the lives of gay men. Join us on tonight's episode when my guest Jamie describes the album cover that turned his life around.
The entire world came to a complete halt when I saw this image.
The topic is the B-52s, Bye Bye Birdie, and the Sewers of Paris. How do you balance a need for solitude with a need to collaborate? This week's guest is Jamie Pierce, an actor, comedian, and dancer who's no stranger to career changes. Several years ago, he decided to transform his work and his life after an experience on stage. And just last year, he reached another turning point, in part because of this show. I originally interviewed Jamie back in 2016, but then his episode kept moving around in the schedule, and a few months went by before it was going to appear. But then Jamie contacted me to let me know that our conversation started him thinking, and eventually led to him making some pretty drastic decisions about his career. So I interviewed him again about that experience. This episode starts with a chat we recorded in 2016, then you'll hear a new interview that we recorded more recently about how one of the pieces of entertainment that changed his life wound up being this podcast. Big thanks to everyone supporting the Sewers of Paris on Patreon. I could not make this show without you. If you're enjoying the show, please help keep it independent and ad-free with your pledge of support. Just go to sewersofparis.com and click Support the Show on Patreon. And you can also leave a review of the show, thanks to Seattle Rain, who wrote, "There are some gem interviews on this podcast." Your feedback on the show is super important to me, even when it's critical. As Seattle Rain continues, "There are too many where I'm listening and thinking to myself, so who is this queen again and why are his opinions important?" Well, I guess my answer to that is that opinions can be a way to see something familiar from a different perspective. And that's a real gift, the opportunity to better understand other people and to better understand creative works that you thought you knew, whether it's a movie, a book, a song, or a podcast. You can follow the show on Twitter and Facebook. Just search for The Sewers of Paris. I post clips of the stuff we talked about each week and also chat with listeners about the entertainment that changed their lives. And I love to hear from you. You can write to sewerspodcast@gmail.com. Now, here's Jamie. Hello, welcome to the Sewers of Paris. I'm speaking to New York comedian Jamie Pierce. Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
As a kid, I was truly a misfit. And so the pop culture that I really connected with in my childhood was the B-52s.
So how did you discover them?
As I mentioned, you know, I was you know, really a misfit, and on the outside and the inside. And at the age of about 10, I would show up to middle school wearing outrageous outfits. I remember one particularly memorable one was consisted of an all-black ensemble, including my mother's black stretch pants, black cowboy boots, black bolero hat, with neon yellow gloves. And this one outfit pretty much guaranteed universal disdain from the entire junior high community. But I thought I looked fabulous. So I would wear these outrageous outfits and my mother's mascara and pretty much say and do things that were considered weird by all accounts for a 10-year-old boy. And I was also a very sickly child, having developed rheumatic fever, which impaired my ability to do anything physical. Not that I was much of a natural athlete to begin with. So I was pale and chubby and odd, which really stood out in the extremely homogenous demographic landscape of small town Utah, which is where I grew up, Park City specifically. And it wasn't that I was like deliberately trying to be different or attract negative attention. It's just that I didn't know how else to be, you know, it was just instinctual. So I loved music, and my father had a very extensive record collection. And I would spend hours after school just combing through these LPs, which mostly consisted of classic rock and folk music, like Eagles, Fleetwood Mac, things like that. But one fateful day in 1989, I happened upon a previously undiscovered album, which I actually later learned was not my father's, but had been left by an uncle who had been staying with us. And it was the B-52's 1980 release Wild Planet, otherwise referred to by fans as the Red Album due to the color of its sleeve. And also on the cover was a photo of the band, including the two female members in their retro futuristic thrift store 1950s regalia, you know, complete with the beehive hairdo. It's very kitschy, very unique. But also the three male members of the band, who we would later learn were all gay, although gay wasn't even a concept to me at that time, other than the fact that, you know, every single day of my life, multiple people, multiple times a day would call me fag. But even so, fag was like an abstract idea that usually just meant weird or unmasculine, which nobody, you know, could argue I wasn't. But and my peers often told me that I should be wearing a dress. So gay simply meant a guy who was considered a girl. Anyway, so I first laid eyes on that album and the cover and its, you know, very distinctive iconography. And I remember the, like, not to be overdramatic, but the entire world came to a complete halt when I saw this image. And I will never forget the simultaneous feeling of attraction and fear. You know, I was fascinated by what I was seeing, but also totally terrified by it. After that first time seeing it.
Why were you terrified?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what I was. I was scared of what I didn't understand fully yet, if that makes sense. You know, I wasn't quite, it was connecting with me on a level that I hadn't tapped into. And I think that seeing this image is what really kind of awakened, previously unearthed feelings inside me, but also resonated with the misfit that I was. Even though I didn't necessarily identify myself as a misfit, I think the rest of the world did. But for the first time, I was seeing something else out there in the world that was as strange as I was.
So you described how you dressed and the kinds of things that set you apart. So, I mean, surely you must have been aware that I'm a little different from the other kids. What was the thing that this, tapped into, the thing that scared you that you hadn't really realized had awakened?
You know, I don't even think I knew at that time, and I don't even know if I know now. Maybe I was afraid of my facing this aspect of myself, this kind of weird otherness that I knew was inside me and was getting reinforced by, the world around me, by the environment that I was in. And these people looked so freaky. And I think that a 10-year-old boy, I think that image was just very, very intense and very severe. And I think that was what I was responding to, if that makes sense. And I remember, I looked at the record and I was too scared to even remove it from the sleeve. I think the image was too strange, but also too familiar, if that makes sense. And I knew at this point that I was considered a freak and that what I was looking at was pretty freaky, especially in contrast, again, to everything around it.
So was it okay, well, I'm a little weird and these people are super weird. And so if this is the road I'm going down, it's not going to get any more normal.
Exactly. And I'll tell you, it actually took a few attempts before I even put the record on the player. When I put the needle on the record, which makes me sound very old. But I finally, because the knowledge of the album, the knowledge of the album's existence in my home really haunted me. Again, I don't mean to over-dramatize here, but when you're a pre-adolescent gay kid, everything seems heightened. And, add that to my inherent theatricality, of course. So when I finally worked up the courage to put the needle on the record, the first song on the album begins with Breaking Glass and Fred, the frontman, screaming, "Surprise!" Which, this confirmed my worst fears. This was more than I, this delicate flower, could handle. And also, people forget, the B-52's origins were really steeped in punk new wave. We know them now mostly for their kind of poppy Love Shack sound, but their early stuff had, a real rawness and an edge. So, once again, I was terrified and put the record back immediately, even 30 seconds into the song. I think I knew that this was something that was going to really affect me. So maybe I was just, going slow with it. Maybe I was just, easing myself into the next phase of my life because, again, I'm pre-adolescent, so I'm about to enter a new phase of self-discovery and awakening, and I think you can't just go into that too lightly. You have to again, be very delicate.
So you keep kind of taking it out and then putting it back on the shelf, and it seems like you're kind of tiptoeing up to it. So was there a point at which you're like, all right, I'm just going to listen to this music?
Well, yes, actually. And it was a really magical moment because I was at home one day and I was listening to MTV was on the television, which I watch pretty religiously. And it was New Year's Day 1990, and the song came on the TV, and it was like what I was hearing kind of started vibrating on my own internal frequency. I looked at the screen and it was that band. It was that band that I, from the album that I had. And I think at that moment, I knew that my identity as a B-52s fan was preordained.
It's 1990. Let's shake our honey. You know it's a new year.
Happy New Year to you.
Spread peace and good cheer. Now it's the new year.
Happy New Year to you.
Describe for me what it was that you were seeing on the screen.
Well, this was the first time I was really hearing the music. So the image had attracted me, and now the music was attracting me. And I recognized the images of the band members on screen, which it was actually a live performance that they were doing of one of their classics. And I made that connection. And at that point, I took out the record and listened to it, you know, from beginning to end, and really just fell in love. So the images and the music all of a sudden were coming together. And again, vibrating on an internal frequency that I didn't even know I had, but was now all of a sudden, you know, being discovered.
So what started to change? Like, after you finally listened to this forbidden album, what changed in your life?
Well, you know, so much of what I loved about the B-52s is how much fun they were having, not despite of the fact, but because of the fact that they were such freaks. They were, you know, taking all that made them peculiar and queer, you know, in both senses, and they were playing in it like a sandbox of weirdness, and you know, they were colorful and silly and groovy, and the men had that gay sensibility that was clearly, again, connecting with me on an unconscious level, and the women were almost like drag queens, you know, with the wigs and the accessories, very Fellini-esque, which was actually, the band almost named themselves Fellini's Children because of their look, which I love that. I think that would have been a great name for a band. But the whole band, they had that thrift store aesthetic that I also found so delightful. So not only, you know, again, did their music resonate, but the image did as well.
So you found this band that's having a good time. Was it, at the time, did you, I don't know, was it difficult for you to have fun? Because it sounds like that's something that you gravitated towards.
Well, I think that was a game changer. I think that this kind of 10-year-old boy found a place where I could see an example of where being different was not only tolerated, but celebrated. The B-52s taught me that if I were to revel in what made me unique, you know, life could be a party. And, you know, these were people who were successful in life because of who they were. You know, what a concept. And I think after that, I really started to become more comfortable in my own skin. And I credit my discovery of the band with that. I think in this current atmosphere of kind of bullying and suicide, I recall my own experience as a gay youth. And when I look back on that period of time when, you know, I received constant, unrelenting ridicule, you know, from my peers for being different, I know what it was that allowed me to keep my head held high and, you know, prevented me from doing harm to myself was this band and the example that they were setting.
Did you find that it emboldened you to be even more of yourself?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And not only to be yourself, but not take yourself too seriously. I'm a comedian, and I think that they have such a great sense of humor. And I think I learned that too, to have fun, be silly, which is kind of sometimes difficult for anyone who identifies as an artist, since we're all pretty angsty. But I really do try, you know, at that point and since, have tried to live my life with, you know, a sense of playfulness and also distinctiveness. Because in comedy, you know, you really want to stand apart. You don't want to be like anyone else. You know, in other words, like, different is good. And the more unique you are, the better, since being derivative in comedy is a very bad thing. And the B-52s are so distinctive in their sound that nobody else can possibly sound like them. And the same is in comedy, and I think in life as an individual, if you base your act on your individuality, you won't come across as hack and people can't steal your jokes.
So what was individuality for you then? Like, what was the stuff that you did that's so Jamie?
You mean besides wearing my mother's mascara and bolero hats to school?
That is a good one. But like, so like, what did B-52s make you feel more comfortable doing?
I think that they made me feel more comfortable to get on stage with a mic and speak freely about who I am and not to be afraid. And I'm not saying I'm able to do that all the time. I was emboldened to go out there in front of people.
So you were a performer then at that early age?
Pretty soon after that, I started doing theater and I started, you know, doing acting and dancing, which was pretty remarkable for a kid who couldn't walk at one point. And I did all the plays in, you know, my story after that was pretty typical for a gay kid. I started doing all the high school musicals. I went to college for ballet. I actually was a ballet major in college, so...
Was that like a shock to people? Like, did they know that that's something that you wanted to do?
I think I'd always, again, had a theatrical sensibility to myself. So I don't think it was so much a shock that I wanted to make a spectacle of myself. But I think that it was a shock that I was manifesting this aspect of me into something creative and productive and that produced something successful. I think that that was a surprise. I also think it was a surprise considering this pale, chubby, odd little boy that I was, that I ended up a ballet dancer. I think that was definitely a surprise.
Was ballet something that you had wanted to do for a long time, or were you holding yourself, or was something else holding you back?
I think the fear of myself was holding me back, if anything at all. So when I finally started to become more comfortable, and I think discovering the arts, as it were, did help me to come out, which I came out pretty early in life. I was 14 when I came out of the closet. And I think that once I was comfortable with myself, the rest of the world was comfortable with me as well. And I really think that's a huge, huge secret, because I just think you put the rest of the world at ease with your own sense of security in yourself.
So what were the B-52 songs that you were obsessed with as a kid?
Oh my gosh. So the B-52s have gone through a couple incarnations. They lost their guitarist in 1985. Their lead guitarist, Ricky Wilson, died of AIDS. And prior to his death, I think their sound was iconic and classic. So their first two albums really are very, very punky, very new wave. And that's really what I responded to the most. And I think when Alf, you know, the band is... the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. You know, the band is not the individual members. It's when they all get together. And when all five of them were creating music and jamming to create their sound, there's nothing like it. It's lightning in a bottle. So the first two albums I really, really love, especially kind of the harder edge stuff. I think my favorite song, though, is Private Idaho, which is, you know, pretty well known. I think from their early stuff, Rock Lobster is probably the most identifiable song, but Private Idaho is up there. And I like it because it's all five members equally contributing to the sound, doing what they do best, because they're all pretty unique and they all contribute something unique. And I really love that particular piece. And the video for it is out of this world in terms of the imagery.
So can you describe to me how each of the members are contributing in that song and what you're seeing in that video?
So the lead singer is Fred Schneider, who has, I mean, talk about distinctive. I mean, nobody sounds like him, and he doesn't, singer is not the word for him. Like, exclaimer, I guess, would be declarer. You know, he kind of forcefully says his piece within the song with really, really abstract concepts and lyrics and just really kind of bizarre imagery that he conjures with what he writes and what he says. And he's the exclaimer, and he's really, I think, part of what makes them sound like nobody else. And then you've got the two women who, when they sing together, create these just otherworldly harmonies that I really think that's my favorite part about the band, is these harmonies that they create that are sometimes they're atonal and they have just a dissonance, but at the same time it just works. And their voices, when they sing apart, sound different, but when they come together, it's just this beautiful blend. And so they create this kind of three-way rapid fire exchange between Fred and the, you know, doing his exclamations, and then the girls doing their really beautiful but also haunting harmonies. And then you've got Kate, one of the girls who has a very high voice, and so she would do a lot of make a lot of sounds that sounded like they were coming from a keyboard or a synthesizer, but they were actually produced vocally. And then you've got Cindy, who has kind of the deeper wail. You know, she's got this kind of this guttural sound to her that just really, I love it. And then you've got the two, you've got Keith and Ricky, who were providing the musical aspect of it, who were writing the music, creating a space for the vocalists to work within.
What is that song about?
That's hard to say what any of their songs are about, because again, they're very, very abstract. And the way that they write is that all the members get together in a room and they just jam and they just toss out lyrics and melodies, just kind of stream of consciousness off the top of their head. So there's not always cohesion to the story, to the narrative, or if there even is a narrative to their songs. But there's aspects of radioactive clocks are one of the things that are discussed in that one. Also, I think being an outsider, you know, living in your own private Idaho, which is again kind of the thing that I responded to with the band. Yeah, it's very hard to say, and I think open for interpretation.
And you were sort of living in your own private Utah, right?
Exactly. That is, and something I can also identify with. Yes, just one state adjacent.
So tell me about the performances that you were doing. What kind of shows were you in?
As I mentioned, I was a ballet major in college, and I danced briefly for a ballet company there at the University of Utah. And then I went on to do musical theater. This is before I even started doing comedy. And I danced in the chorus of some musicals, some regional productions, and one here in New York. And what I liked that a lot, dancing and singing and, you know, carrying on. But
why did you like that?
Well, I liked it because it's fun. I mean, that's always fun to, you know, be in the chorus of a musical. But I think what I didn't like and why I left it and pursued this other avenue is because it really is about homogeny. I mean, it's about fitting in and looking the same, and everyone kind of does the same thing. And there's a pretty tight, narrow box that you have to fit into. I think that is why I left that aspect of performing.
It must have felt a little bit like a return to like the pressure of when you were younger, like that pressure to, oh, well, be like the other kids.
It really did. And I think, I don't know if I recognized that at the time, but I just wasn't happy doing that. I think that it was a goal, a personal professional goal that I had set for myself to become a professional dancer and, you know, be in the corps de ballet and, you know, be in the chorus of the show. I think I felt stifled.
So what was it that you were looking for that was missing?
I think an opportunity to express myself, my thoughts, my opinions, use my brain. You know, being a dancer is very physical mostly, and I wanted to express myself as Jamie. And it certainly is, you know, being in a musical is really fun, but I just don't think that I really wanted to share my thoughts and opinions. I wanted to speak and have people listen to me. And so that's why I went into stand-up comedy.
What did you want to say?
You know, I didn't even think I knew, and I still don't know. I really feel strongly that a comedian needs to have a point of view and get on stage not just with the intention of making the audience laugh, but also to communicate something of substance. Here's how I view the world, and let me offer my unique perspective, and also let me kind of celebrate myself and what makes me unique, and giving everyone else the opportunity to do that too. It's not just all about me, but just everyone gets a turn at the mic to kind of celebrate what makes them an individual. I really like that a lot.
You also, like, from going from kind of the weird little outcast kid to a performer and doing something very physical, that you actually experience sort of a physical transformation to just the way that you look.
Yeah, I did. I really did. I had to work very, very hard at that because, like I mentioned, I was not a natural athlete. I was not naturally a physical person, and I was very sickly too. And I had to transform myself. But I think a lot of that sickliness and that physical ineptitude was based in feeling shameful about who I was and or afraid of who I was, perhaps. And so I think part of the physical manifestation was, or transformation was, that enlightening, you know, internally, and coming to terms with who I was, I think facilitated that physical transformation.
Like, physically, what changed in you?
Oh, well, I could walk again. I don't want to overstate my illness, but it was, you know, I had rheumatic fever, which is a disease that affects the joints, and it can become chronic. Mine, fortunately, was not. But I really was just a homebound kid for all those years. And so when I said to my mom that I wanted to take dance class, she was like, okay, this should be interesting. And so I really had to go work to find out, you know, all about my body and, you know, discover how it moves and what my facility was and what I was capable of, but also the confidence to go to the dance class as that fat little boy. I think it's pretty remarkable now. I'm so brave. I don't know if I would do something that brave nowadays, but it is, you know, I felt empowered.
I mean, when you first started going, it sounds like, I mean, you weren't just like, oh, he has two left feet. I mean, how restricted was your movement when you began?
I think it was actually a pleasant surprise how physical I was. I took to it pretty quick, actually. And I think that I think I had a natural propensity for movement. I just didn't know it at the time because I was sheltering myself from it. And so I actually took to dance pretty well and found that I had a pretty good, again, kinesthetic awareness. And I had a lot of things that recommended me as a dancer that were surprising to me. Although as I got older, I think I was fighting against, I knew that it had a shelf life. And I knew that eventually I would have to move on and retire, because there's a lot of physical upkeep that goes along with that. And I think, again, I look back on it, I really think you become more fearful as you age in some ways. In other ways, you become bolder. But I think when you don't know what the risks are when you're young, it's so much easier to take the leap, literally and figuratively. I didn't know any better. So, like, why not? Why not try it? You know, if that boy could show up with the bolero hat and the neon yellow gloves, that's a pretty bold move. And if he's capable of that, I think that, you know, nothing else is nearly as scary.
How did you feel when you looked in the mirror? Like, how did you feel about who you saw?
Oh, that's a good question. I was proud of it, but I'll tell you something. You asking me these questions makes me reflect on the fact that I don't think I analyzed these things that much. I've become so analytical later in life. But when you're a kid, you just kind of accept things as they come. And so, you know, one minute I'm bedridden, the next minute I'm in dance class, and I just kind of went with it. You know, oh, I'm gay. Okay. And, you know, you just kind of do it. And you don't second guess it. And I think that, I think there's a little part of me, even though I was very proud of who I had become as a dancer, I think there was a little part of me, and still is to this day, that misfit boy is still inside me. So I think that I saw who I had become, but also inside felt like who I was. And I think everyone's kind of constantly, wrestling with both of those internal states. My father would say that I was trying to get negative attention, and maybe there's something to that, but I actually think that it was more that I just didn't know how else to be. You know, it was like the misfit boy didn't know how to channel the strangeness into positive attention, I think was the difference, is that I wasn't seeking negative attention necessarily, but I just didn't know what to do with this oddness. I didn't know what to do with this creativity. I didn't know where to put it. And I think that, again, Park City, Utah, in the 80s, early 90s, I was very, very, very different. And I really think that no matter what I did, I would have, even if I had tried to hide, I don't think I would have been able to.
Did you find that, like, when you became a dancer, just when you were studying dance and getting good at it, did you find, like, people who were like, oh, he's such a weirdo, suddenly were like, oh, now I get it. He's a dancer. He's a performer. He goes up on stage. That's why he's like this. Did the attention become positive?
It really did, and it was a very sharp pivot from being weird to being celebrated for this artistic triumph, you know, because I finally figured out a way to channel it. But also, I really think it was that I discovered who I was. I came out. I started to feel comfortable again. And so that just put everybody at ease. That put everybody at ease. And I said, okay, now I'm going to do this thing. Everybody watch. This is awesome. And they were like, yeah, that is awesome. And so I think it was me just taking control of the situation. And again, making feeling confident so they could too.
When did you come out?
I came out of the closet in high school at the Bye Bye Birdie cast party, actually.
First, I want to know who you were in Bye Bye Birdie.
I was Hugo. That's a lie. I was Harvey Johnson. I really wanted to play Hugo, but I was Harvey Johnson.
Oh, describe Harvey's character.
Oh, poor Harvey. He's the one that has whose voice cracks in the middle of the song. And I was a freshman, so I was 14. I was a freshman in high school, and I was cast as Harvey Johnson in Bye Bye Birdie, which I thought was a throwaway part, but it actually ended up being a pretty good scene stealer.
Well, I heard they got pinned.
Yeah, yeah.
I was hoping they would. Yeah, they're living at last.
He's gone.
Going steady for good.
Hello, Mr. Hankel. This is Harvey Johnson. Can I talk to Penelope Ann?
Is it true about Kim?
Penelope?
I just knew it somehow.
About the prom.
I must call her right up.
Saturday?
I can't talk to you now.
And I remember getting a lot of laughs and a lot of, again, positive attention for that, because I decided to just kind of own it as the geeky kid, because he's really, again, kind of the misfit boy of the bunch. You know, he's the loser that nobody wants to hang out with. And so I think I was like, I know this. I know how to do this. And I also know how to make it stand out. And it was actually, it was a pretty auspicious debut.
I want to make, like, a super cut of all the Harvey Johnsons from all the different Bye Bye Birdies that are done by, like, little high schools and things. Because it's always, like, where the drama teacher's like, oh, boy, where am I going to stick this shrimpy freshman? I know. I've got the perfect role for him. It's such a cute little bit part.
That would be amazing. We should definitely try and compile that for a YouTube clip.
So you were poor little wallflower Harvey, and then how did you come out at the cast party?
I mean, I think I knew that I was attracted. Again, there's no analysis that goes on when you're that age, I don't think. So I knew gay was an abstract concept, but I remember there was a girl in the cast who played this secretary that does the splits. I forgot what her name is. You know Bye Bye Birdie, the character, the secretary that does the splits. She said to me, because there was a lesbian at our school who was out, and her name was Tracy. And she said to me, the secretary said to me, you know, Tracy's gay and nobody cares. And I remember everything shifted in my mind. I was like, oh, it's a thing. Like, being gay is a thing. Like, it's a thing that you do. It's a way that you live. It's an identity. You could say label, but I understood it from an abstract concept to a concrete concept. And I was like, oh, I'm gay. Great. Let's do this. And that was that. I told everybody kind of slowly, one at a time, you know, starting with close friends and finally moving on to family. And I think that there was no surprise. I mean, I think that's a pretty typical situation. I mean, considering what we had seen previously from me, I think that for friends, it was no big deal. And, you know, this was 1994. I think my parents needed a minute, but once they kind of got their mind around it, then they saw it coming. So I think they had time to adjust. And then once I made it official, they processed the information. But what really helped was the fact that I was really coming into my own as a performer, and I was finding a lot of confidence in that. And I think that it was easier for them to accept that because I was they were able to celebrate my accomplishments. And I think that they saw that I was going to be okay, because their fear was a gay kid, especially a weirdo gay kid, is going to have a really difficult life. But if it's this, you know, successful contributing member of society, I think they felt a lot better about that.
You're finding stuff that you could get positive attention for that previously seemed like a liability.
Yeah, and I think, again, I think that was something I learned from the B-52s, to be completely honest. I have a B-52s tattoo on my left hip, and I think that it...
What's the tattoo?
It's just their logo. It's very small, and it's kind of on my waistband, so unless I'm completely naked, you can't see it. But it's more just like a reminder and kind of a monument to that discovery that I made about just, you know, the courage to kind of be myself. And I think that lesson I learned, that take what makes you different and unique and celebrate it, again, revel in it, channel it into a successful, you know, happy, playful, productive life. I mean, that is what they were doing. They were successful because they were weird, not despite the fact.
Do you remember the first time you saw them in concert?
I do. So it was January 21st, 1990, and it was just 3 weeks after that New Year's Day discovery on MTV, when I finally played the album in its entirety. Seeing them live was just, I mean, I remember everything about it. I remember I went with my dad took me. I remember where I sat. I remember buying a concert T-shirt. I remember most of their set list. And I just, it was a foregone conclusion that this was going to be my obsession for the rest of my life.
When you close your eyes and you think back to that first concert, what do you see?
I see, that's so funny, I see Cindy's dress, go-go boots, and a long sleeve, it was kind of like a, Erica Jane on Real Housewives of Beverly Hills was wearing something similar the other night. I don't know if you watched that show, but I was watching it. I was like, oh my God, that's the outfit that Cindy wore. But what was different about it is that it was sequined. And I just remember it sparkled, and she had, you know, her blonde bouffant with the ponytail. And I really remember that image of seeing her and just having her sparkle on stage and just being like, wow, I want that. I want more of that in my life.
Did you have a feeling like, I want to be up there too?
One thing that's very interesting about the B-52s, in contrast to other things that I've done as a performer and an entertainer and in show business, is that I've always liked to keep the band kind of at arm's length. I have met them several times, and they're lovely, lovely people. But I really like to be an audience member. I don't think they were an inspiration for me to get on stage necessarily. They were an inspiration for me to live an authentic life, as Oprah as that sounds. I think that was what they inspired me to do, was to live as myself honestly. And then from that came the leap into performing.
What was the thing that made you decide to make a switch in the kind of performing that you were doing? Because you had those kind of background roles and you were a dancer. Was there like a show that made you realize I've done everything I want to do here?
No, actually, it was that notion that I need to develop some other skills, because dancing has a shelf life. I'm not sure if I want to do it anymore. Stand-up comedy was something I was always a fan of, and so I signed up to take a class, and I saw that it was, perhaps I was good at it, but it was also an opportunity to really be creative and be very expressive. I thought, it wasn't a show necessarily. It was kind of me trying it that said, oh yeah, I think that I want to dive into this a little bit deeper. So I took the class, and then I started going to open mics to just see if I could do it. Again, I wasn't necessarily thinking, oh, let me pursue this as a profession. But then the open mics started to lead to other performing opportunities where I would be in front of a real audience. And I found that, again, I really liked the creativity, because you're writing, you're performing, and you're directing yourself. So I would go to open mics, and I started performing in front of audiences, and then I started getting paid pretty soon after I started, too. I would say within a year, I had my first paid gig. And then I was like, well, I've got to see where this goes. And then I never stopped. I've taken time off here and there to do other things, or to, you know, to kind of take a break and reflect from it, but I still keep going back to it, because it's just something that really calls to me.
How did you find doing stand-up to be different from the kind of performing that you were doing before?
I mean, it's could not be a sharper contrast. They are two sides of opposite ends of the spectrum. You know, you have your kind of written act, but it can easily go off the rails for a number of reasons, because you forget, or somebody heckles you, or you have to address a situation that's occurring in the moment, or you're bombing and you have to address that. So there's really no safety net. Whereas, you know, if you're doing a big theater production, there's so many different elements that you can use as not a crutch, but that you can use for support, where it's very, very vulnerable up on stage alone with a mic.
Why do you like being vulnerable?
I don't know if I do. I don't know if I do. Like, I mean, I really prefer it more when I'm in control, but I really think that to gain that control with an audience, you have to be vulnerable. When you're in the chorus, most people aren't looking at you at any given moment. You have maybe a third of the audience at best who are paying attention to you. But when you're on stage alone doing stand-up, that's it. You're it. So they're, for better or for worse, they're only paying attention to you. But it does create an opportunity to connect, and you can connect with them as you. You know, you're always playing a role, a character when you're doing theater. Certainly there's an aspect of yourself that you know, you hope to put out there. But when you're doing comedy, unless you're doing a character like Andrew Dice Clay, which I'm not doing, Andrew Dice Clay. I'm very much myself. If it doesn't go well, I take it personally, because it is me personally out there on stage. I still bombed a lot in the beginning, and still do to this day. I don't bomb like I used to. Like, in the beginning, I would bomb, like no laughter, just, you know, crickets. Now sometimes you have what I call softer sets, where maybe it's not, you know, you're not doing bad necessarily, but you're not killing. But when you're starting out and you have performances that where the laughter is consistent and your delivery is consistent, you know you've got something good, at least the raw materials for it. And I would get feedback from other comedians saying, you have a lot of potential. You know, even if it wasn't perfect, they were saying, you've got a lot to work with here, so keep doing it. And that kind of feedback from the audience and that kind of feedback from colleagues really is what fueled me and said, oh, something is clicking here. Let's keep going. I think in the beginning, I would just kind of get up there and I would be very scared, or I would have a false sense of confidence that was false, because I wasn't confident. And I think that they can smell that on you. They can sense when you're nervous. They can sense when you're putting on airs. And so I've learned to have fun with them more and be more playful and make sure that everybody's having a good time, including me. And that really helps a lot. And it's still going on. I mean, I think that it takes decades to become a really, really skilled, really, really skilled comedian. Takes a lot of years and a lot of shows. If you suck, if you're dancing and you're not good, you don't necessarily know if they agree. Like, you know, you could think you're doing great. They could think you're terrible, and nobody knows. Like, they're still going to clap at the end. But with comedy, like, you know if they don't like you and if you're not doing well. You know immediately in the moment, and that's a big, big difference. And so sometimes I kind of miss, like, maybe I could go out there and dance and just not be very good, but nobody would be able to, I wouldn't be able to tell the difference. I miss that. I sometimes envy those people who maybe are writers or people who do TV and film, where they make it and then they send it out into the world and they're not even there in the moment when people are reacting to it. And I think that sometimes it's kind of like, oh, well, I put it out there and whatever happens, happens. I don't necessarily have that luxury. I kind of have to, you know, be in the moment. And if it's not working, I have to try and adjust accordingly to make it work. And so while that can be very satisfying when it goes well, it can also be devastating when it doesn't. So it's a give and take.
So if you're having devastating experiences, why keep at it? Why is this what you're doing?
That's a good question. I don't know. I like the creativity of it. I really do, because again, you're all aspects of the performance as the performer and the director and the writer and the producer too sometimes. And I really find that I can do that independently of anybody else. Although I do like to collaborate and work on projects with others, I like that I can be wholly responsible for a work, you know, a piece of art
Do you have memories of particularly successful stand-up shows?
You know, you don't remember the successes as much as you remember the failures. I've had a lot of really great shows, from small ones. I remember a show I did in a coffee shop in LA that was maybe, I don't know, 15 people. That was one of the best shows ever, just because everyone had such a good time and I had a good time. And then I remember a show I did to a 1,500-seat theater, and it was great, and the audience was wonderful, and it was a great show. Though they all tend to kind of bleed into one, it's really the spectacular disasters that stand out in my mind. And fortunately, I haven't really had them in the last few years, but from the you know, origins, from the beginning days, I have several. In fact, I remember one time performing a few years in, and I was doing so bad, they turned out the lights on me in the middle of my set. They just turned off the lights. And I mean, that was painful, you know? And so I wrapped it up and left.
What was going through your mind when those lights went off?
I mean, just kind of like, could it get any worse? I mean, it was going so badly and I was so bad and they hated me. And then to turn off the lights was just kind of the final sock in the gut. And so I was just, and I was thinking back to that. I don't know why I kept doing it. I think it was just the challenge and, you know, wanting to see if I could. And then knowing that I had previously, you know, I think you're always kind of chasing that. When you know that you can be successful and effective, you kind of want to continue to do that.
That, I mean, you must have been very tempted at that point to be like, this is it, this is my last show, but there was something pulling you forward.
Well, and I think that's why over the last 10 years, I have left stand-up and I've, you know, gone to try other things, you know, with his writing or doing, you know, something like what you do with the podcast, things like that. I've tried to do other things that are also creative over the years, because sometimes you do start to get a little bit tender after doing a series of unsuccessful shows. They do start to wear on you over time. But I think that the challenge, again, to, 'cause when you know it can be good, you want to go up and try again and see, oh, I know I can do this. I know I can do this. Let me give it another shot. And I think that's what keeps me going. And I think a lot of other comedians.
You mentioned that the B-52 song that you're obsessed with is always changing. So what's the song that you're obsessed with right now?
There's a really, one of their few kind of melancholic songs. They don't have many. Most of them are pretty upbeat, but they have one that's a solo for Cindy, one of the two females, called Ain't It a Shame. And I was listening to it this morning, actually, and I was thinking, even though some of the lyrics are still have some kind of silly, ridiculous imagery, the overall sense of the song is a little bit more somber. And it's also at the time that Ricky, the guitarist, was dying of AIDS, and you know, he died before the record was released. And so I think that really colors when you listen to it. I think that really, really informs the experience of that song. And so I like that within their catalog, even though the majority of their songs are very, very happy, there are these other kind, there's different notes along the way. There's different colors. And that's a really beautiful song.
Did you need a melancholy song? Like, what was it that made you want to listen to it just now?
You know, it's hard to be perky all the time, you know, and especially, you know, comedy, you're having to be on and funny all the time. And I think that, you know, with the B-52s, you have to put some deviation in there from time to time. And so I don't know if it's necessary that you were feeling, or I was feeling melancholy in the moment and needed that, but it's nice to within, you know, if you're listening to an album, it's nice to have different moods within that. And that was one of the different moods that they offer. So you're not just constantly bombarded with cheeriness.
Well, having a balance of emotions is just being a human being. It's just being honest about what life is like.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's important to kind of go with that emotion. And I actually think even in comedy, even though it's about laughter and funny, I think it's within a set, you know, especially if you're doing a longer set. I like to vary it up in terms of now I'm talking about something where I feel a little bit more uncertain. Now I'm going to talk about something where I feel very confident. Now I'm going to kind of make me the butt of the jokes. Now maybe I'm going to, you know, make fun of my mother-in-law for a while. She's a lovely person, by the way. But, you know, I'll kind of, you know, change it up even within my own set to, so it's not just the same thing and not just kind of the same emotion all the time. I think that's important. Like you said, it's what makes us, it's our layers. It's our onion.
So you've got more permission now to have those varying emotions instead of just putting, literally in Bye Bye Birdie, there's a song called Put On a Happy Face. You don't have to do that.
Absolutely. Because there's the Harvey Johnsons of the world who are really feeling the pain. I mean, he's not putting on a happy face. He is full of teenage angst.
Yeah, Harvey Johnson's like the melancholy Hamlet of Bye Bye Birdie.
He really is. And everyone laughs at his expense, which I think is, you know, kind of sad and sweet. And so thank you, Harvey, for giving us a moment of levity, even if it is at, you know, the expense of your heartbreak.
Is that something that you can find on stage now? That maybe it's not heartbreak, but something more melancholy that you can find the laughter there and share it with people, honestly?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And there's a couple things there, because I do think that finding humor and developing comedy based on something that was very painful and traumatic is very healing and very therapeutic. But I was actually watching a documentary last night on the writer and filmmaker Nora Ephron, who died recently. And I love her work. I think she's so insightful, and I think she gets associated with these romantic comedies, but her writing is so sharp and witty and, again, very insightful. But she said that if you slip on a banana peel and everybody laughs, you're the victim of the joke. But if you tell the story of you slipping on the banana peel, all of a sudden it's your joke. And so she says, you know, be the hero, not the victim of your story. And I think that that's absolutely what comedy is that you, by telling it and putting it out there from a first person perspective and allowing those things to come out and not trying to, you know, hide them away, you actually become the hero of the story. And I thought that was very poetic. Well, I think telling this story right now about my misfit childhood was something that we could look back. I could look back, with shame on, but instead I'm seeing how it led to these wonderful discoveries, and it led to a self-discovery, which I think is really, really wonderful, because I think it could have gone a couple of ways. Like I said, I mean, bullying suicide is a real thing that we face now and always have. And who knows how the story could have unfolded. And I'm really, really glad that I'm able to look back on that and see the narrative take shape and feeling bold enough to be strange and be a weirdo actually was what led to success in life, rather than, you know, because you kind of have a choice at that moment to live or die, either, you know, literally die or kind of die inside. And I think that that's a choice that I made, and I'm really glad that I did. Thanks to the B-52s.
Jamie, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Matt. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's been some time, but we're popping back in again to check on Jamie. How's it been going?
I've missed you, Matt. How are you?
Good. I'm very well. So, you know, we recorded quite a while ago. I think it was a bit over a year.
Yes.
And then, you know, for various reasons, your interview just kept slipping around in the schedule and it hasn't gone up yet. Unfortunately, that gives us the opportunity to check back in. Tell me about what happened after we chatted the first time.
Well, it was interesting because we were discussing how I had transitioned professionally from being a theater actor into doing comedy. And I had explained my reasonings because I had started my professional life as a chorus boy and, you know, in musical theater. And I really loved it, and I loved being part of an ensemble, but I felt after many years this need to kind of break out from blending in. And I found that very liberating, and I found that to be very good for me to develop my own thoughts and opinions. But when we were talking, you were asking me about, you know, why I had left theater and why I didn't do it anymore. And I had given those reasons, and I think they're valid reasons, but it actually got me thinking about, I don't know if that was something that I could maybe still include again in my life, because I really did love it. And I think being forced to examine that helped me to realize just, you know, where I had come from and what my first love was.
How long had it been since you had done theater?
10 years.
And did you, were you aware of missing it?
Not, I mean, I guess, no, I wasn't aware of missing it until I was kind of forced by you, Matt, to talk about it and explore that. And then I realized that, yeah, I did miss it. It did have something to offer.
What was the last thing that you were in? Like, what was the last play that you were in?
So the last thing I did before I transitioned into doing comedy, I had done a piece with Tony winner Karen Ziemba. I was one of her backup dancers, and we had done this piece, and we had performed it in Bryant Park as part of the Broadway and Bryant Park series in New York. And it was this really huge moment because she was an idol of mine. I loved her so much, and she had inspired me to do what I was doing at the time. And I was surrounded by these, you know, the cream of the crop in terms of, you know, Broadway talent and particularly male ensemble dancers. I was one of them, and we were doing this show in Bryant Park on this huge stage in front of 4,000 people. It was the middle of August, and I remember looking out and seeing not only the crowd, but New York City. I saw the skyscrapers and the taxis, and I thought, it's never going to get better than this. And I remember feeling like maybe this is a good cap. Maybe this is a good cherry to put on the sundae. And that was the last thing I did. And I kind of walked away and didn't really look back for, again, 10 years.
So how did you start looking back? Like, after our conversation, what were you thinking back about?
Well, I went so far the other direction from being a member of an ensemble to being just standing alone on stage. And I think that because I had the pendulum had swung so far in the other direction, I kind of realized that I needed a little bit of the other thing to balance it out. I think I'd just gone from one extreme to the other. And what's interesting and kind of ironic is that I moved to Los Angeles about a little over a year ago, right after our conversation. It was kind of unrelated. My husband and I just wanted a change, and he had some opportunities out here, and I had, you know, toured doing stand-up in quite a bit in California, and I was thinking that maybe I would, you know, try my hand out there. And strangely enough, it was actually LA where I decided, or I discovered a theater scene out here that I didn't even know existed. You just don't associate Los Angeles with theater. And I think that gave me kind of a safe place to dip my toe back in again. Mm-hmm. And I thought, maybe I'm going to go audition. There was a couple projects. I thought, well, I'm just going to go audition. It's low risk. Nobody knows me out here. If I fall on my face, then, you know, I'll just pick myself back up again and, you know, soldier on with my comedy career. But it ended up taking. So who knows?
Well, what did you audition for?
I auditioned for, they were doing a production of Urinetown, the musical, and they were looking for not only, you know, musical theater performers, but they were looking for people who had comedic sensibilities. And I thought, okay, this is a good way to get back in again. And so they wanted comedians. I went in and I sang my 16 bars, and it had been a long time. Oh my gosh, I don't remember now. What did I sing? This is so embarrassing. I sang The Devil You Know from Sideshow. I don't know if you know that song, but it's so inappropriate for me, and that's kind of why I wanted to do it, you know, juxtaposition.
I'm not gonna tell you you're making a mistake. Tell you not to go, no I won't. I'll only say what I've learned along my way.
The devil you know beats the devil you don't. We don't work in the best of situations. We don't live very well. We don't live in the neighborhood of heaven. We live somewhere closer to hell. Now we have learned to...
And I got it. I got cast in a principal role, and it was...
What was the role, and what did you get to do?
I was cast in the role of Mr. McQueen, the wacky, flamboyant assistant, which was right up my alley. And it was a great opportunity to kind of use some of the skills I had developed doing comedy, but also call upon my previous theater skills too. And it was this kind of great blend. And I really found it satisfying to be part of a group again, to be part of a ensemble. There was a bunch of comedic actors, and I actually met another comedian in the group who also did stand-up, and he and I started doing podcasts, actually. We still have that going on. It's called Necessary Distraction, and it's excellent. I encourage everyone to check that out. But it was filled with kind of a combination of comedians and then theater actors. And what I discovered in this process was that there was actually a pretty robust theater community in Los Angeles of actors and performers with diverse backgrounds. And I really kind of found a family there.
Well, tell me about that family.
Well, interestingly enough, this theater company that I did this production with, we had such a good experience, and you know, they were familiar with my background in comedy, that we're actually going to be doing a production of Buyer and Seller, the play that started off Broadway with Michael Urie. Mm-hmm. And what I'm so excited about with this show is that it's a fantastic hybrid between theater, acting, and stand-up, because it's a solo show, it's a one-man show, and it's 90 minutes on stage alone. You're playing a bunch of different characters, and you are expected to sustain a comedic performance for, you know, quite a whole evening by yourself. And that's certainly something I have familiarity with, but it's also very much storytelling in the traditional theater sense. So I was really excited to find this family, because they embraced me fully, but also have been taking advantage of my skill set and kind of the unique thing I had to offer. So I felt from this discovery that I didn't have to give up what I had been doing previously. I was able to kind of combine them.
It's interesting to me that that's the show you're doing, because you got back into acting to work with other people, but you're going out on stage all alone, just like before.
I know. Isn't that interesting? I think that, again, like I said, trying to find something in the middle, maybe, between doing something all by yourself to doing something with others, but maybe kind of vacillating back and forth between the two. And the nice thing about doing a play, even if it's a solo show, is that unlike stand-up, where you are the director, you are the producer, you are the writer, it's still a collaborative effort when you're doing theater. Somebody else is there giving you direction. Someone else is there oftentimes having written the piece, that you are saying their words, you're inhabiting a character, you're having somebody else's ideas, speaking somebody else's words. So even though, yes, I'm alone on stage, I'm still part of a team. And so again, it's kind of like this best of both worlds.
So you did You're in Town, that would probably been like about a year ago?
It was last November, yeah.
And now you're doing Buyer and Seller. So have you been doing stand-up as well?
Yes, still doing stand-up. And I've been really enjoying the podcasting. It's been really, really fun. And my podcast partner and I also have a live act that we've done. He's a musician. He plays the guitar and sings funny songs. So we do some musical comedy and some stand-up still. So not only in the theater world have I, you know, kind of discovered some new associations, but in the comedy world, I've also brought some people on stage with me. So I'm making, you know, it takes a village. I'm including sure. other people in this experience, whereas for kind of the last 10 years, it was just me by myself.
Did you feel a bit like a hermit doing that kind of work?
Absolutely. Especially when you're on tour. You know, I got married, and I got married a long time ago, but it was kind of in the thick of when I was on the road, and I found that it was so isolating. It's kind of you against the world out there when you're doing stand-up, because you travel by yourself, and then you perform by yourself, and I think in some ways it was good. It was a self-discovery process, and I still like to do that. I still like to, you know, be alone with myself and with my thoughts and my creativity. But you sometimes start to miss collaboration, for sure.
So it sounds like you still had some self-discovery when you started doing more drama and more collaborative kind of work. What's been your self-discovery process in the last year?
Figuring out that I could still do what I had done previously, that it wasn't this all or nothing. Like, I had to completely abandon everything that had come before it. And maybe I'm just kind of an all or nothing person. I do find that I go to extremes, as we've discussed. And so I'm trying to find this balance of understanding that I have lots of different things to offer, and understanding that I can use my whole self in my life, in my creative process, in my career. And that's been liberating, because I think it's good to diversify your portfolio and not put all of your eggs into one professional basket, as it were.
So do you still feel about that last performance like that was the cherry on the sundae? And I mean, obviously you don't feel like you can't go back.
Well, no. And, you know, especially because I was a dancer, and I had really felt that, because I was 25-ish when that happened. And in the dance world, there's this kind of idea that you have to retire at a young age and that it's over and that your career ends. And another thing that I've done in the last year, in addition to doing Urinetown, I was in the dancing ensemble of a big musical. There's a big theater company here in Long Beach called Musical Theater West, and I did a production of Carousel, and I was cast as one of the male ensemble dancers. And I was cast amongst other, you know, again amongst 25-year-olds, the age I had been when I had retired. And here I was, a good 10 years older than them. And it was amazing to discover that I could still do a lot of those things. Maybe I did them a little bit slower than I had before, and perhaps than the others, but I was pleased to discover that I could keep up, and I could still twirl, and I could still do those kinds of things. I think that the creative team believed in me more than I believed in myself, and that was a tremendous experience, to not only be doing theater again, but to be dancing again.
Do you believe in yourself a little bit more now?
I do. And I kind of wish that I had discovered this a long time ago, because I would have, I mean, thanks to you, Matt, you came at the right moment. But I wish that we had interviewed years before, because I really missed it so much, all the different self-expressions between, you know, speaking as myself as a comedian, but acting and singing and dancing, all of these different things. There is no age limit on it, and you can kind of do it forever in some capacity. And I love it. And I think that I want to, you know, continue to do it in some way forever.
So what's next? You've got Buyer and Seller, but what do you want to, like, what's the next Sunday that you're going to be working on?
The next thing that I'm going to be working on is continuing with the live act that I have with my comedy partner and doing our podcast. And we are going to continue to kind of take that act on the road while I start working with the director on Buyer and Seller. But I think that once that's over, I'm going to just stay open. I'm going to stay open to opportunities and not limit myself and see what's interesting. And maybe I'll dance again. Maybe I'll do, you know, a cabaret act. A friend of mine, Mark Reese, he's 52, and he just did a cabaret act. He's a former dancer, still a dancer, and I was one of his backups for this show that he just did here in town. And it was so inspiring, because he's 52 and he's still kicking above his head and, you know, doing a solo show, singing and dancing and telling stories. And I just feel like there's no limit to these types of things.
Yeah, it sounds like what you're saying is that there doesn't need to be a cherry on top. There doesn't need to be a conclusion like, this is as good as it gets, so I'm done. You could just be like, well, that was fun. Let's do it again, or let's do something a little different, or let's try something new.
100%. That is such a lesson that I have learned in this process, and I'm, you know, didn't come a moment too soon.
Well, Jamie, thank you again so much for joining me.
Oh, Matt, thank you so much for having me back.
Big thanks to Jamie for joining me. You can follow him at JamiePierceNYC on Twitter to keep up with his adventures, whether venturing out on stage as part of an ensemble or going it alone in a solo show. For this week's recommendation, take a look at another notorious loner with the movie Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Like every Pee-wee project, it is utterly delightful, ridiculous, and queer. The plot concerns a stolen bicycle and a fever dream of a quest to recover it. Early in the movie, Pee-wee declares himself a loner and a rebel, a line that's funny enough on its own, but is absolutely ludicrous given how many friends he has and how many friends he makes. At every step of his journey, Pee-wee wins over everyone, even the most hostile gang of bikers, by being completely bizarre, because that's just who he is. He's guileless, weird, not always polite, but always honest about what he likes and what he doesn't. Back on episode 117 of The Sewers of Paris, I recommended Pee-wee's Big Holiday and noted that he is, to be sure, a very strange boy. Giddy, curious, playful, and sincere. And so is everyone else he encounters. They're all strange in their own way, from a phony psychic to a spooky truck driver to a sweethearted waitress. And in Pee-wee's company, they all seem completely comfortable to be strange, happy with whatever makes them weird. Everyone is uniquely bizarre, each a loner and rebel in their own particular oddness. But this movie has them all rebelling together. They're loners, but they're never alone. Thanks again for listening. If you're enjoying The Sewers of Paris, I hope you'll join the folks who keep the show going. Each episode takes about 10 hours to produce, so head over to sewersofparis.com and click Support the Show on Patreon to pledge $1 or whatever you think it's worth per episode. Huge thanks to all the patrons who make the show possible, and you can also leave a review of the show. That helps too. You can also follow the show on Twitter and Facebook. Just search for The Sewers of Paris. I post clips of the stuff that we talked about each week and also chat with listeners about the entertainment that changed their lives. And I love to hear from you. You can write to sewerspodcast@gmail.com. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin MacLeod of Incomptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time, croissant.